This is Series 3 of Brave New You Tribe, and I'm Lou Hamilton, co-founder with Meredith Heppner Chapman of the clothing brand Brave New You. We welcome you to the stories of real-life Brave New Girls who are creatives, brand builders, entrepreneurs, health practitioners, and campaigners who have the courage to overcome challenges, push the envelope, and envision impactful possibilities for the future. This week's guest is Vix Monroe, an entrepreneur, money enthusiast, and wealth coach with a mission to help women step into their financial power and become money savvy in both life and business. She helps them fix their money mindset so they know exactly where to find their financial G-spot. Welcome, Vix, to Brave New You Tribe. Hi, Vix. How are you?
Hi, good. It's a nice Monday morning. Start of another week.
Start of another week. Yeah, fresh start. It feels like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I always think that about Monday mornings.
Yeah, even in the pandemic where everything feels, every day feels the same.
Yeah, every day does feel the same, doesn't it? Although I do try at the weekends to not do so much work and get out. We actually went to Richmond Park yesterday, so that was good.
I think walks are saving everyone, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
We are still in the middle of the pandemic, but it's looking like everyone's sort of getting it under control a bit. So the light is at the end of the tunnel, but there is a sense that there could be some kind of economic fallout. And definitely there have been people who have been impacted through the pandemic. I wonder how it's treated you, and as you've been building Money Badassery, what you've seen happen with the economy and what you think is going to happen and how people can kind of somehow soften the impact.
Yeah, well, I think it's been difficult. I mean, it's been a difficult time for everyone, clearly. And I mean, on a personal front, I've probably been one of the lucky ones because I've had money coming in the whole time. I'm also aware, as you say, that, you know, there is a light at the end of the tunnel, but there's still potentially a lot more economic fallout. I actually believe that, you know, we've had a lot of government stimulus, and obviously that's meant that the fallout hasn't happened earlier. But eventually, some of these businesses are going to have to decide whether or not they have a future or not. I personally can't see all the pubs and restaurants reopening or staying open. I just think things have changed and things have moved on. And, you know, whilst building my business, Money Badassery, I've encountered women who've experienced the pandemic differently. There've been women like me who have still managed to bring in money and haven't really been affected financially. In actual fact, they've been better off. Like, I'm actually better off because I haven't spent that much money during the pandemic. You know, I'm not going out to the theatre. I'm not going to restaurants. I'm not going on holidays. I did get one holiday in last year, but other than that, you know, I'm not really spending that much money. And if you've still got money coming in, you're better off. But then there's been other women who haven't been in that situation. And I think one thing I have seen, though, is a lot of women start to think about entrepreneurship as an, you know, as an option, really. Women who've been in employee roles who are now thinking, actually, these, you know, being an employee isn't as safe and secure as it used to be. There's a lot of risk associated with that now. And the only way I can be certain of my future is if I create it myself.
And so setting out onto sort of an entrepreneurial journey can be quite a minefield, or kind of expanding it if you've had to pivot from, you know, maybe a bricks and mortar business into an online business. But it's a lot to do with your own mindset, isn't it? You know, whether you feel resilient, whether you feel like, yes, it's been tough, but I'm going to somehow find another way. Yes, I'm going to start my own business. Okay, so I lost my job, but, you know, I can now kind of do something to bring some kind of money in. Mindset is a big thing, and it's something that you look at a lot with the women that you work with. And something that you said was that what happens in childhood very much affects your money mindset as an adult. So should we go back to your childhood, and your money mindset coming into adulthood was definitely not what it is now, and that was affected by things in your childhood that happened. Can you take us back to when you were a wee girl living in New Zealand?
Yeah, so yeah, absolutely. First of all, I just want to say that I absolutely agree that your mindset is key to so much that of what you do, you know, whether you have a fixed mindset or a growth mindset. And obviously, I focus on money. So I'm talking about both the practical side and the emotional side of money. And the emotional side is the money mindset. And I think, you know, as you said, you know, your childhood is really important in your money mindset. It's all those subconscious beliefs you get. And sometimes things happen. And so your money story is dependent on things that happened in your childhood. So I think the key things that happened in my childhood were death. So I had two sisters that died. One was 3 and I was 4. And then the second one was 1 and I was 9. And then when I was 11, my 35-year-old mother died. So I think a lot of, you know, my early kind of memories or my early experiences in life were about death and grief. And I think that can have a huge influence on your mindset, you know, and particularly your money mindset. Obviously, prior to my mother's death, my parents were both very frugal as well. So I grew up in a household where we were always not just making ends meet, but, you know, trying to get good value for money. And my father would go out of the way to save money. Like he would drive to a local bakery every Monday morning to buy the bread for the week, which would then go in our chest freezer in the basement because it was so much cheaper to do that than go to our local corner store, which we called a dairy in New Zealand, and buy bread every day. So, you know, my parents were always doing things like that. But yeah, I think the death has really, really affected my mindset. I think, as I said, I was 11 when my mother died, and she was 35, so she was very young. I mean, I'm now in my 50s, so 35 just seems so incredibly young to die, and, you know, traumatic. It was a traumatic event. And I think what I learned from my mother's death, or what I told myself after my mother's death, is that we're here for a good time, not a long time. I looked back at her life and seeing that, you know, she married young, had 7 girls, and a lot of her life was spent at home, and then she died young and didn't get to do the things that she used to talk to us about wanting to do. So I think I decided then that I'm going to do everything I want to do because I don't know how much time I've got. So I was very much into, you know, any money I got as a teenager, I just spent. It's like, I'm here for a good time, not a long time. This is what I want. Money can buy me fun. Money can buy me good times. And I did that right through my 20s as well. And it wasn't really until, I was going to say until I got to my mother's age or was older than her, 36, that I really kind of turned around my money story. Although I will say that I did buy my first flat to live in when I was 33. So I was a bit of a late starter. My sisters back in New Zealand, I had 4 sisters back in New Zealand, and I was the second oldest, but even the 3 that were younger than me had all bought property well before me.
Going back to that grief as a child, so, you know, when you're little and you lose someone, you don't really understand the impact it's had. And you think, well, so why would grief impact how you think about money? But it's sort of about the deep-rooted belief that things that you care about get taken away. And so did you feel that as a child, or was that something that you felt sort of kept showing up for you?
Yeah, no, it's definitely something that's kept showing up for me in my life, really. I think that fear, I mean, I was very scared of death for a long time. I probably still am, actually. You know, I don't want to die. I feel I've got a lot more to do. So I'm definitely, you know, have a fear of death. But also that, you know, you love someone and they're taken away, or something you have is taken away. And, well, apart from the first sister to die, my younger sister, when she died, it was just sudden. It kind of happened over a weekend. And same with my mother. She went into hospital on a Monday morning for a routine operation, and she died on the Friday. So within 5 days, she was dead. So it was that kind of really sudden thing that something can be there one day and not the next. And it's hard to, you know, when I look back now and think, okay, what exactly was I thinking at the time? Even during my teens or my 20s when I was spending all this money, I look back now and I didn't really think about it. I wasn't conscious of the fact that I'm going to spend all this money because I might die. It was just something I did. It's only now, you know, later on in life with hindsight that I can look back and think, wow, you know. But I do remember my 36th birthday, because I suddenly thought, I've lived longer than my mother. And I've read a book about, it's called Motherless Daughters. So it's about girls who lost their mothers when they were children. And it's interesting because everyone who was interviewed for this book said exactly the same thing. A really kind of key moment or pivotal moment in their life was when they reached the age that their mother was when she died, and they were suddenly, they'd lived longer than their mother.
When you lost your mother, it was on the back of having lost your sister. How did you grieve?
Yeah, it was difficult. I think, you know, it was in the 1970s. It was like people didn't really talk about it as much as they do now. And, you know, my father, you know, was suddenly left a single dad with five children. And my parents had a traditional marriage where my father was the breadwinner and went out to work and my mother was a stay-at-home mother. So suddenly, like, the trajectory of all our lives had suddenly changed. And also, I think as a father or a man in the 1970s, they were definitely not comfortable talking about their emotions and talking about grief. So it wasn't really talked about. It was just kind of, let's just get on with it. So, and it was suppressed. So that pain, that kind of fear, it was all suppressed, really.
So that kind of goes into your bones, doesn't it? And as you say, you acted on it by living a sort of a fairly hedonistic lifestyle. So at some point, did you feel like you could see that that's what you were doing, that you needed to somehow help yourself to unearth these things? Or did you just sort of crack on and say, right, I need to change my mindset when you'd passed that age that your mother had died?
Yeah, it wasn't actually a conscious decision. It's only now that I look back that I can actually see the process I went through. It was more like, hang on a minute, I've got to sort things out. I've got to get things sorted. It wasn't really, really conscious. And, you know, as I said, I'd bought a flat a few years earlier. And timing did play a part in this because, you know, I bought my flat in 1996. And, you know, that was kind of almost at a low in the property market at that time. And then 3 years later, it had increased a lot in value. And some friends of mine were buying investment properties. And I thought, hang on a minute, I can do this too. Why not? You know, I can remortgage my own flat, take out some money, take out some equity and get a deposit to buy another property. And doing that once, it kind of started that process of, hang on a minute, yeah, I can create a better future for myself. I can create a life in which I do all the things I want to do now, as well as, you know, a comfortable life for myself in the future. But I think the other thing that I realized is that, you know, I didn't actually have to spend all my money to have a good life now, because I think one of the things I realized is that whilst I was being hedonistic, you know, I wasn't getting that much pleasure out of some of the things I was doing and spending my money on. It was just like spend, spend, spend. And I think, you know, I one of the things I talk about now is, you know, when spending money, to ask myself, you know, does this bring me joy? Does this thing or experience I'm going to spend my money on, does it bring me joy in a Marie Kondo kind of way, like on a scale of 1 to 10, how much joy does it bring me? And previously, I might have spent money on things that were a 5 or even a 4. And it was a way of refocusing, saying, no, it needs to be like an 8 or 9 or a 10. And ideally a 9 or a 10 in order to spend money on it, because otherwise what's the point? I spend money on something else. Because, you know, every spending decision you make, if you spend money or invest it or whatever you do with that money, it means you can't do something else with it, because, you know, there's this pot of money that you're going to do something with. So you're always, there's always an offset.
So you came to the UK from New Zealand in your early 20s with about 30 quid in your pocket.
Yeah, I know, crazy.
Having kind of had a good time around the world, and then you sort of land in London and lie on a few people's floors, but you do get a job and you do go into the corporate world. Can you explain about the kind of work that you were doing and then how that started to change into thinking that you wanted to have your own business?
Yeah, well, I'd studied accountancy at university in New Zealand, and I, on the way to the UK, went backpacking around Southeast Asia for 7 weeks, and I wasn't planning to arrive with that much money, but I certainly was planning to arrive with a lot more money than £30. And we spent a lot more money backpacking around Southeast Asia, and we even got some flights, which we weren't planning. We were planning on the long overnight buses, so it was kind of a bit of a shock to suddenly arrive in the country with £30. And luckily, we had someone's floor to sleep on. We slept on, you know, yoga mat type things and our sleeping bags on the floor in someone's flat. So we were actually lucky to have a roof over our head. The person I was with managed to get a job pretty much the next day working in a cafe and getting paid daily. And I got a job within a couple of days as well working for a Japanese bank. It just took me a bit longer to get paid. So, you know, I was lucky that I was in a position that I had a floor. I was with someone who was getting paid in cash every day so we could afford to eat. And then once I got paid, we were able to get our own flat. With hindsight now, I don't recommend doing that unless you've got, you know, someone to help you at the other end. But I suppose I then pretty much worked in the corporate world for a long time. Oh, actually, I did go work for a charity as well, actually. And then I actually went back to university and studied, and I did my master's and then went back into the corporate world. So I did work in the corporate world for a long time. And it's something I was working as an economist, and it was something I'd always wanted to do and was, you know, really fascinated with, was everything to do with money. You know, I've always been passionate about money, passionate about investing, passionate about the economy. And one of the things I saw around me was a lot of women who were not confident in dealing with their finances, you know, not investing their money and almost not facing it front on. And I thought, gosh, I was kind of quite surprised because I think in my family, and I had sisters, we were all pretty confident, you know, about managing money. We may, you know, I didn't do it, but I knew what should be done. I didn't do it because, you know, of my mindset. So I think that made me realize that it's something I want to do. I want to work in the money space. I want to be involved in educating women. I want to see more women become financially empowered because I think financial empowerment for women is a really, really important thing. And it has a ripple effect, you know, because when women become financially empowered, it has an impact on the community around them as well as on their children.
So, yes, you'd hit your 36th birthday and realize that you were in this for the long haul, this thing called life. It was going to last longer than you thought. So you'd better start thinking ahead. And yes, whilst you had, you know, you had a decent income, you'd already invest in property, you wanted to build on that, and you started to look at sort of other investments. So you began to think outside of your salary and the one extra flat that you had. What was the desire to have a security beyond a salary?
I bought my first investment property and it was relatively easy. You know, I got some equity out of my existing property, bought it, had no trouble renting it. The rent money was coming in, covering the mortgage. I suddenly thought, wow, this is the future. I can, you know, create a good life for myself by doing this. And this is how I'm going to build up a property portfolio. So I initially was very focused on buying properties, and that was my sole focus because I saw property as being the way forward. And it was around about the time that I read that book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I can't remember exactly when I read it in terms of my property journey, but obviously that book is really about property and, you know, building, growing a property portfolio. So I was really focused on that. Now, I did have a pension with my work, and I remember going to see the financial advisor to choose which funds I invested my pension in. And I went for high risk because, you know, that was kind of my personality, and I was young, and that's a good thing for young people to go, you know, into high risk funds because you generally get a better return, assuming they do well. But interestingly, the financial advisor was, oh, no, no, you shouldn't be putting so much money into property. You should be doing this. But I was like, no, 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 no. Property is the way forward. But after about 10 years of being mainly focused on property, I suddenly started to realize, actually, I've got all my eggs in one basket here. And if there's a large property crash, and we did have a bit of a property crash with the global economic crisis in 2008. If there's a big crash, I stand to lose everything. So I need to be a lot more diversified. So it was at that point that I started to invest a lot more into equities, so stocks and shares, and look at other types of investment and invest a lot less in property. Because I think I felt that actually, in terms of having a diversified portfolio, which is kind of a de-risk portfolio, I'm overweight in property. So I need to stop buying property and really focus on other investments. And I initially focused on equities and then went on to focus on precious metals and other commodities, so gold, silver, as well as other commodities. And then in the last 4 years, I've also focused on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. So I now believe that I'm a lot more diversified than I was. But obviously, it depends, you know, which way the market goes. And I'm still overweight probably in property. That, you know, if I was starting out now, I would have less of my money invested in property. But I'm not going to sell it because there's a lot of transaction costs in selling it. But yeah, anyway, so to get to your question, which was about, you know, what was driving me to do this. And I think it's about securing my financial future. You know, it's about wanting to have a good time and live a good life now as well as in the future. And I always talk about my financial G-spot, which is that sweet place where you feel really confident that you're putting enough money away for the future whilst living a good life now. And I think it's a place that everyone can find, but it may mean that you need to bring in more money in order to find your place. Because it's about, you know, every spending decision is, should this be money I spend on my current life or should this be money I spend on my future life? I invest it for the future.
So you obviously have a very good understanding of money, of finances. You have a good financial strategies. You've got a good background to be able to make these kind of decisions and understand them. But the women that you're working with don't have that kind of background and qualifications. So what's the expectation that they can have in terms of both from their money mindset, but also from their strategies? I know that you've got 7 stages to financial freedom. So first of all, how can women who don't have your financial understanding and know-how, how can they become more secure and reach out financially beyond making a living or running a business?
Yeah, well, I think it's all down to education. And, you know, it's not rocket science. I think there's kind of a view that it's really complicated, it's going to be difficult to learn, and consequently, a lot of women shy away from this. But it is education. I mean, something I always say is that, you know, it's not just about having good financial strategies, because you need a strong money mindset as well. And where the two intersect, that's where the magic happens. But I talk about, you know, educating yourself, understanding where you are now and where you want to be. And I talk about, you know, the stages. So the different stages are like the first stage is financial dependence. And that's when you're dependent on others for help. That might be your parents, it might be the government, it might be someone else. So basically, you cannot support yourself financially on your own. So that's financial dependence. Now, many people, you know, from the moment they're in adulthood, might never be in that stage, but others are. So it's, you know, it's kind of like a spectrum, and understanding where you're on in that spectrum. The next stage is financial solvency. So that's when you're not dependent on others for help. You likely have debt. You can afford the repayments, but you're not kind of getting, you know, if something bad happened tomorrow, you wouldn't have money to cover it because you're just kind of dealing with your debt. And the next stage is financial stability. If you're financially stable, you're likely have an emergency fund for unexpected events, but you're not going to have savings or investments. And then the next stage, so we're now up to stage 4, is financial security. So you will have some assets and, you know, you can cover your basic, you know, if something goes wrong, you can cover your basic survival needs. You'll have an emergency fund if something bad goes wrong and you can cover it, and you can cover your basic survival needs. Stage 5 is financial independence. That's when basically you have enough investments so that you can cover your basic living costs. So, you know, you don't actually necessarily need to work because you've got investments, you've got returns from those investments that can cover, and as I say, just your basic living costs. So not the fun things as well. That's when you have financial freedom. So it's when you can cover your basic living costs and the things you want to do in your life. So that is what financial freedom is. But there's also one further stage, which financial abundance, which is you have more than you'll ever need. And most people don't aspire to a financial abundance. They actually aspire to financial freedom, which is you can live the life you want without needing to work in the future. So that's what most people are working towards. So we often talk about the stages of financial freedom and the 7 stages. And what people need to do, I think, is identify which stage they're at. And yes, if they want to be financial freedom, which is stage 6, and they're currently in financial financially solvent stage two, it's about seeing it as a step by step process. So what they should be doing is aiming for the next stage. And then when they, and only when they get there, aim for the next stage. So, because I think if you're, you know, stage two, financially solvent, and you want to be financially free, which is stage six, that's a big step. And it can be overwhelming and too much. And I think that kind of scares people. But if you kind of break it down and think, okay, this is where you are, this is your next goal, you know, it's like we say, break big goals down into lots of smaller goals. And that's what you can do with these stages of financial freedom.
If, for example, someone, if they're on furlough, yep, and they've got some debts, that might be sort of credit card or...
Yeah, or overdrafts. Or even bank loans, actually, like often car loans. A lot of, depends where you live. If you live in London, where, you know, we both live at the moment, people tend to have cars less. But, and you know, depending when you live, you could have a car. Car loans are very common.
So you're a bit nervous that you might lose your job when you come out of furlough. What can you do to try and get rid of the debt, to try and lessen the debt, to then be able to get to the next stage?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of things. So if you're in furlough, I mean, it can be quite a worrying time because you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, none of us know what's going to happen, but it can be really worrying. But I think at least with being in furlough, you have got some money coming in at the moment. And I think what I would suggest is to sit down and look at all your outgoings. I mean, that's a key thing to do. Where is your money going? And assess. And, you know, to be honest, you should be doing this even if you're not on furlough, but assess if it's appropriate, because our three big ticket items in terms of spending are housing, food, and transport. Obviously, people are probably spending less money on transport at the moment. Food, I mean, by food, I mean your day-to-day food that you're eating at home, because eating out in restaurants would come under entertainment. And then housing, and it depends, obviously, if you rent or if you own your home and have a mortgage, because if you rent, and you are worried about the future, maybe you need to think, okay, am I paying too much rent? Could I live in a smaller place, or could I live with other people, or could I live in a cheaper area? So there are things you can do in each of these big ticket items to save money. But I think the key thing, you know, if you're worried and you want to be more financially, if you want to be financially stable, the first thing you need really is an emergency fund to cover any unexpected bills. And if you don't have one already, or if you don't have enough, and when I talk about emergency fund, I'm really talking about 3 to 6 months worth of money to cover your basic living costs. I used to say 3 to 6 months, but I think with the pandemic, we've realized that the importance of an emergency fund, and many people didn't have one. So I'm now saying minimum of 6 months expenses. I mean, maybe even more, depending on, you know, how comfortable you feel with 6 months. Some people are now feeling, because of, you know, what the pandemic meant, and it brought up lots of anxiety and issues like that, that actually they'd rather have 12 months. So I think focusing on having an emergency fund is really, really key. And depending on your debt, I would be looking at doing those at the same time. But if you have a lot of debt and it's really high interest rates, maybe you just need to try and pay that off first because you're paying out a lot. But otherwise, I'd say pay off your debt at the same time as getting an emergency fund. And then, you know, and then after that, then get other savings and then start investing and then invest more. So it's like a step-by-step approach to get there.
You're focused predominantly now on helping people, women, to retire rich. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, well, when I talk about retire rich, I talk about retire rich in every way. So it's not just about having, you know, money in the bank for the future. It's about having a vision for the kind of life you want to live in the future, as well as, you know, living a good life now. So it's not, you know, some people are a bit like put all your money away from the future and just scrimp and save now. I'm not that. I'm about having a really nice balance. That's why I talk about this financial G-spot. You know, you can have a good life now on the things you really, really want, but make sure that when you spend money, it is on something you really want, not just because money's there. I mean, we see a lot of people that get into retail therapy, don't we? It's just spending money for the sake of it. It gives you a quick high, but it's gone the next day. Yeah, so when I talk about retire rich, or when I talk about being wealthy, it's not just about financial wealth, money. It's also about time wealth, which is freedom, or physical, mental, emotional wealth, which is health, or social wealth, which is relationships. It's about being really clear about what you want for the future. So having a really clear vision of the kind of life you want to lead. Now, it needs to be realistic as well. I mean, you know, if you're in a, you know, struggling with debt at the moment, then you're vision probably isn't you're going to live in a palace somewhere lovely and have this multi-million dollar lifestyle. So you do need to be realistic about that. But once you've got a vision of how you want your life to be, then you can look at, okay, what, how much money is that going to cost, and what do I need to be doing to ensure that I have that in the future, and how much money do I need to be putting away in terms of investing. So it's about a vision and then a plan and then action. And as I say, I'm not someone who's saying who, you know, have a good life in the future at the expense of your current life. I mean, one of the things you may find that's missing when you start doing this is you're not bringing in enough money in order to put away enough money to have the life you want in the future. So either you need to downsize your future plans, or alternatively, and I think this is the best approach, look at how you can bring in more money now.
That's an interesting thing. And we're in the sort of entrepreneurial world, so we're sort of used to the concept of sort of having multiple revenue streams. If you're in business or you're in a job, what, how do you start to think about having different revenue streams?
If you're an employee and having a job, you do have less power over money coming in than, say, an entrepreneur, because an entrepreneur can launch a new product very easily. But there are things you can do. One, you can look at seeing whether or not you can get a salary increase. So you can approach your boss and ask for a salary increase if you believe that, you know, you provide value and you're worth more. So that's one thing. Another thing is you can look for a higher paid job in your industry. A lot of people who have jobs, you know, in full-time employment at the moment are now starting a side hustle. And obviously you can invest in property. So that's the way I started. I was an employee at the time. I was investing in property. You can invest in anything, but I just think property is quite a good one when you've, because it's kind of like a mini business as opposed to investing in stocks and shares within your pension, because, you know, you've got to run it, you've got to find a tenant and those kind of things. So I still think even for employees, there's lots of ways that they can be thinking of to bring in more money.
I think with all of these strategies, every time you sort of got to where you are and then you're thinking about, well, what can I do next to help myself, you know, the things that you can do, but you then come face to face with your mindset. So it's sort of back to mindset again. So at any stage when you're having to do something new, how do you work on this money mindset and try and sort of help yourself? Because it's always a risk, isn't it? The next step, the next little thing that you haven't done before, you don't know how to do. So you don't know whether you can do it. And if you're not confident about, and you haven't got the right people around you or support, and it is down to you, how do you build a money mindset that gives you resilience and allows you to sort of push past what feels safe?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is to understand what your money blocks are. And it's things, you know, like, there's really common ones. You know, we grow up thinking, you know, rich people are greedy. I'm never going to be rich. You know, it's okay for them. They've got money. I mean, there's lots of things you can do to actually understand what your money mindset is. But one exercise I suggest is to take a paper, piece of paper, and write down money is, and then whatever comes up, and do that 20, 50 times and see all the things, and do it quickly. Like, don't take time to think, just write whatever comes to your mind. And then look back on it. And for all the negative things, so if it's something like rich people are greedy, change that to, you know, either rich people are not greedy, or rich people are no different to poor people, or rich people are just like you and I. So you've got to change it to something positive about money. Or if it's like, I will never be rich, it could be, change that to, if you want to be rich, to, you know, I'm working, or I'm learning about how I can become rich. So change it to something positive and that you believe in. And, you know, I use money affirmations a lot, and you can find a lot of money affirmations on the internet. For example, one I love to use is, you know, I'm a money magnet, or, you know, I love money, money loves me. That was a really good one, given that was Valentine's Day yesterday. And I mean, some people use affirmations during meditation. I'm not good at meditating, so I prefer them to be visual. So I prefer to kind of write them down and with a nice picture and kind of put them around my house so that I see them all the time. And when you see something all the time, like put them on your fridge, you know, I'm rich and fabulous or something like that. You see it all the time and then slowly you start to believe it. Or, you know, or if you're worried about learning, you know, I'm learning how to make more money. So it's kind of because sometimes if you put something too far, you know, like I'm going to make a million by tomorrow. I mean, it's just too much, isn't it? So it needs to be something that's realistic and that you can believe. So I tend to do it visually rather than through meditation. So that's the first thing. And I think the thing with money mindset is, you know, we have these money blocks and we've got to chip away at them over time. It's not going to happen overnight. But one of the things you do find is that, oh, I don't feel that so much anymore and I hardly ever think that. But then, of course, it will come up again at, you know, a moment. But what you'll notice is it doesn't come up so often. And then the other thing I think is, which is what you said, you know, you might not have people around you, find those people. I mean, you know, with social media, there's lots of communities. If you want to buy an investment property, for example, find a community of other people who are who, you know, have jobs and are in buying investment properties too. Because once you start hearing them talk about what they're doing, it can be really inspirational and really motivational as well.
I found with money mindset that I found my own block, and you know, I've got an online business, and I found myself putting the stops on it, and I thought, why am I doing this? And so I actually went and had hypnotherapy, and what came out was that, going back to that sort of grief thing, was that yes, I had lost someone very close to me when we were, I don't know, it must have been 7 or 8. And various things then happened through my 20s. So the message became, when you have things and you love things or people, they get taken away. So very much like you're going back to the beginning, your money mindset. And I found that with the hypnotherapy, what it did was just kind of disassemble that sort of very fixed idea. And I sort of came out of it, and it was a few months ago, and I've realized that it's really allowed me to push myself to really go all in on my business. And suddenly that's really, really exciting. And I'm not scared anymore of, well, if I do this and I'm successful, it's all going to crumble and I'm going to lose everything. Not just the business, I'm going to lose everything.
Yeah.
And so getting rid of that block has been incredibly liberating. And so now I'm kind of looking at your stages and thinking, okay, so where am I in these 7 stages, and what's the next stage that I can feasibly look at, and what do I then need to do to move myself into that stage? So the women that you're working with in Money Badassery, how does that work? Is it a membership group or?
It's not a membership. I mean, I have a group. I have a free Facebook group, so I don't have a paid membership at the moment. It's something I'm thinking about for the future, but at the moment I'm offering online courses. That's really the only thing I'm doing because it's a relatively new business, because I still have my other business and I haven't been able to dedicate as much time, but hopefully that's going to change in 2021. And you know, I've written a book, which I hope to publish shortly, which is about financial intelligence. So really financial literacy. So the 6 pillars of being financially literate, like one of them, they're like making money, spending money, credit and debt, financial planning, saving and investment, and protection. So protection is all your insurances. So that's really the pillars of financial intelligence or financial literacy, whatever you want to call it. So that's what I'm doing at the moment, mainly online courses, which focused on specific things. I have an ebook on my website, if anyone's interested, which is about getting out of debt. So that's for people who are in debt, like what steps they need to do, what method is the best method to apply. But because I'm new, I'm slowly building up resources, but it's mainly online courses. But it's interesting what you said about money mindset, because, you know, about how liberating it feels when you can kind of start releasing some of those blocks. It's amazing.
So there are these blocks, and there's also a lot of fear around money. You know, you talked about belief and different beliefs that people have around money that, you know, started probably from childhood and probably from parents and background and schools and everything. Everything is kind of firing money beliefs at you. With the women that you've worked with, what are the fears that you see arise around money?
One of the fears, and mainly because, you know, I talk a lot about retiring rich, is basically that fear of spending your golden years in poverty, of being, you know, not having any money in the future. Because I think one of the And yet, despite that fear, a lot of women, you know, in their 40s, 50s, are not putting away money for the future. They know that they should do it. It's not that they don't know that they should do it. It's just almost like they feel a bit paralyzed with fear, and therefore they're not doing it. They're kind of burying their head in the sand, procrastinating. And also, for a lot of women, their focus is just on the family and, you know, making sure their family is okay. Whereas, you know, one thing I talk about a lot is we have, you know, we not only have a gender pay gap, we also have a gender investment gap and a gender pensions gap. More men invest than women. I mean, women tend to save more, which is just putting money in the bank. But investing is about making your money work for you. And men are better at doing that, a bit more gung-ho about it. Women have a bit more fear. It's like, well, I want to know what I'm doing, a bit more cautious. And also, we haven't had strong financial female role models. I mean, my mother was a stay-at-home mother and then she died. And I didn't know when I was growing up that many women who were out there, you know, living the life they wanted, that they'd planned for, and were financially independent, like independent from their male partners, for example. I didn't grow up with those kind of role models. I think it's different for younger women now because they do see this. But, you know, we end up being those financial role models, and, you know, we struggle with, you know, the things we saw in our upbringing and the things we were told that we're having to kind of fight against and deal with all these money blocks as well. And a lot of the money blocks are also, you know, about being female as well.
How does that show up?
I mean, one of the ones I had when I was very young, when I was thinking about a career and going to university, and I just remember having this, you know, because I was one of those girls that was really bright at school, knew that I, you know, could have opportunities. And I actually don't have children, but at that time I obviously thought I should. I said, oh, well, maybe there's no point me going to university if I'm just going to have children anyway. And that was what I'm thinking, you know, as a teenager. So that was what had been kind of drummed into me. And I think another thing I see a lot is, and it's interesting because, you know, I've talked about this a bit last week because it was Valentine's Day yesterday, is about, you know, financial issues in relationships. Well, money can cause a lot of issues in relationships. But another thing I see is that even in relationships, that women tend to spend more of their money on family things and men tend to spend more of their money on things for themselves, or they put it away for the future. So even in these kind of, you know, seemingly equal relationships, they're not really so equal after all in many cases.
So if you are in your 40s and 50s and you haven't put money aside, or you haven't prepared for what sort of 10, 15 years time when you're going to retire, maybe you are self-employed or you're an entrepreneur, you've got a small business and you haven't put the money aside for retirement fund. Is it too late?
Absolutely not. There's a Chinese proverb, which is the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The next best time is now. And the same applies to investing. Yeah, the best time, sure, was to start 20 years ago. And if you were someone that started 20 years ago, you're in a good position now. In fact, I started investing in property just over 20 years ago. I think I bought my first investment property in 1999. And I feel that I've built up a really good net worth now, you know, 20 something years later. And the other thing that people say, isn't it, we often overestimate what we can achieve in 1 year and underestimate what we can achieve in 20 years. So it's never too late. I also think retirement's changing. And for a lot of entrepreneurs, they talk about not wanting to retire in the traditional sense that you hit age 65, which is now age 67 if you live in the UK, and just go from, you know, working all day every day to do no kind of productive work. So they talk about more of a hybrid model of, because they love what they do, of still doing it. But even if you do want to give up work completely and live off your assets, then, you know, the sooner you start, the better. And the sooner you start putting money away, the better. The longer you procrastinate, then, you know, the longer away the life you want is.
Let's say you've got savings, you've got income, and you want to start investing at whatever age you are. What's the smallest, least scary thing that you can do to dip your toe into investing when, if you're starting out?
I would say a pension. I mean, in the UK, we call them pensions. So in like Australia, New Zealand, it's often superannuation. I think in the US, they call them, you know, retirement funds. In many countries, there's tax advantages from putting money into your pension. So if you're an entrepreneur in the UK and you have a limited company, you get a lot of tax relief from your company putting money into your personal pension for the future. So a pension, retirement fund, superannuation can be a good way to start. Or some countries like the UK have tax-free savings accounts as one. There's one in the UK called an ISA, individual savings account, and you can put up to £20,000 into that each year. And it's free from income tax and free from capital gains tax when you come out of that in the future as well.
When you find your financial G-spot, you find a balance between living so that you can have a good time now and you've got a good financial future ahead of you. How would you define courage in trying to find your financial G-spot?
Courage is strength in adversity, or strength dealing with pain and grief and things like that, isn't it? So I think in trying to find your financial G-spot, I would say that courage is persevering. It's about being consistent, because I think sometimes financial things can seem really daunting to people, and it can feel really overwhelming and a bit scary. And courage is saying, this is important. This is important for me. It's important for my future. I'm going to do something about it, despite all that. So it's overcoming those pain points, dealing with your money mindset, saying, my money mindset is not going to keep me down. I love your story about your money blocks and going to have hypnotherapy for them, which is great. And as you know, I also had hypnotherapy to stop drinking. And one of my kind of mindset blocks was, I'm not going to be any fun if I don't drink. It was almost like, how can I have fun if I don't drink? And, you know, I'm now almost 8 months alcohol free, and I can still be fun.
You are. Thanks, Vix, for helping us to understand how to shift our money mindset, prepare ourselves for a more secure financial future. You're doing great work with your Money Badassery community and helping women to find their financial G-spot. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much, Vix, for showing us that no matter what our starting point, we can always shift our way of thinking around money so that we can live with more abundance and security in our lives. You can find out more about Vix's work at www.moneybadassery.com and follow her on Instagram at moneybadassery. Thanks also to Podstar PR for producing the series, and to you, our tribe, for listening. Download, rate and review on your podcast provider so that we can keep bringing you this free podcast. Goodbye for now, and see you next time.